Welcome back to the Behind the Play podcast. My name is Alex Adams, and I am joined, I think, for the third time by the Athletics Scott Wheeler. Thanks so much for taking the time and doing this. It was nice to finally meet you at the World Juniors, this around Christmas time, although it was an eventful event. I guess what's this past year been like for you, just kind of seeing this draft class kind of come together, and how have you enjoyed it?
Yeah, this draft class has challenged me in a few ways. I've struggled to find talent, if I'm being honest, in this draft class. I think it's a weak age group, and because it's a weak age group, particularly for Finland and USA, you just show up to the international events, whether it's U18s or Five Nations or that kind of thing, and you tend to come away underwhelmed because two of the countries that are typically loaded with talent just don't have it this year. Especially in Finland's case, there are still going to be plenty of kids picked from that American NTDP team, those 07s this year. But in saying that, those 07s are, you're not going to see a top 10 pick out of USA Hockey, for example, other than James Haggins, who's obviously a late 06 and played at the program a full year ago. So it's been a bit of a difficult year. It's been a slog. I haven't enjoyed it, and I've sort of had that passion for this age group like I have the last few years. Part of that is the fact that we were spoiled in 2023 and 2024 by excellent age groups. 2023, obviously, you had the Bedard storylines all year, but there was Michkov and Adam Fantilli and Will Smith and Leo Carlson. It was a really strong group right at the top. And then last year, really 1 through 12, a really deep sort of top group, obviously led by Macklin Celebrini, but those defensemen, Sam Dickinson, Zane Parekh, Ziv Bouyam, you go down the list. That it just made it fun, and it made it an exciting challenge, especially with six defensemen at the top, because I find defensemen, I think every scout would tell you this, they're just naturally a little bit harder to evaluate than forwards and project than forwards. This year it doesn't have that same juice. You've got Matthew Schaefer, the number one prospect in the draft, is a defenseman, which in and of itself is less exciting, as great a player as Matthew Schaefer is. And then B, he was with the collarbone suffered at the World Juniors when you were there, obviously. And then obviously mononucleosis out of the gate to start the year. He just didn't play a ton. So about 30 games across all competitions. That's Hlinka, CHL USA Prospects Challenge, 17 games in the OHL, and then obviously World Juniors Selection Camp, those games against U Sports that they play, pre-tournament action, all of that. So a very limited year. And then just, yeah, the NTDP doesn't really get the juices flowing, and it's been a bit more of a struggle. There's still going to be tons of talent that comes out of this group, and I've turned around on some players and really sort of gotten reinvested in some players in this group, and I've still got my kids that I really like more than other people. And there's been some great stories to tell in this draft class. We were talking before I hopped on about Simon Wang, for example, who's going to quite likely be the highest drafted Chinese born and developed player in the history of the NHL draft. Obviously, Kevin He of the Niagara Ice Dogs was drafted a year ago by the Winnipeg Jets in the fourth round. Wang's expected to go higher than that. So telling those stories has been great. And there's been a few of those sort of human interest angles that I've been able to tease out on kids in this year's draft class that have been a lot of fun to tell. So that's still a passion, but it's not a great year. And that part of it has made it a little bit challenging. I will say it's been an interesting year outside of the draft in the world of prospects, because you have the USA CHL Prospects Challenge, which I mentioned off the top, a brand new event. That in and of itself didn't have the juice I was expecting it to, because the NTDP is a weaker group. But you had that in November, which was new, and then through the winter, it was just constant reporting on the NCAA and CHL rule changes and what that's going to mean for the landscape. And it's a big deal in this sport, and one of the most significant changes in the pipeline and in the prospect world, maybe ever in the history of this sport. It's going to really send ripple effects, not just through the CHL and USHL and college hockey, but right through to U Sports, who have now made rules to allow pro players to come back and play U Sports hockey, to the BCHL, who just broke away from Hockey Canada in a pretty defiant move, only to quite likely lose many of their NCAA bound prospects that they rely on to sell tickets and to develop and build the notoriety of their own programs. And the OJHL, where Simon Wang played this year, all of these sort of different layers on top of what it's going to mean for scouts and who's going to be playing in the CHL next year, and the CHL getting younger, and all of the top kids that are then going to enter into potentially not even sign entry-level contracts so that they can go and play in college hockey post-draft. So a lot of balls in the air on that side of it. That has been exciting for me because it's different, and it's a big moment in hockey that we're going to be sorting out over the next 2 or 3 years.
What do you think about it all? Like, I guess like empowering players to, likely getting paid at, younger and younger ages. It's going to change. You mentioned the, the CHL, the BCHL, the OJHL. Like, what do you like? And I guess, this might be a loaded question, but is this good for hockey? Is this good for kind of development and for young kids moving forward in the game of hockey?
I think unquestionably it's good for the players, and that's where the focus should always be. More choice for the players is positive for the players. The ability to play in the CHL from now, let's say instead of playing in the CHL from 16 to 20, you now play in the CHL from 16 to 18 or 19, and then you make that move. Some kids will do it at 17, but those are rare cases. The Macklin Celebrinis, those types who are able to complete their high school education early and obviously enter into college early. We're talking about maybe one player a year who's going to do that. The more likely route is post-draft. You sit down after the draft and talk with your NHL club about your next step, and it might just become the natural path for players. Instead of spending those 2 years post-draft in the CHL, top prospects, I think, are quite likely going to be encouraged by their NHL clubs to go the college route. Now, you need grades, you need to get admitted, you need to want to be in a college student. All of those things are a part of it. College isn't for everybody. That's true in life, not just in hockey, but I think especially in hockey, where education maybe isn't always the focus. But in saying that, a lot of kids are going to go choose that route. It'll be great for the players. And I think if it's managed right by everybody across levels, by the CHL, by the USHL, by the NHL, in terms of making changes to their upcoming collective bargaining agreement, which is going to be a necessity, I would expect that the signing rights will align. Right now, teams only retain rights on CHL players 2 years after the draft. It's obviously 4 years for college players and 5 years for European players. I would expect that all three of those rights are realigned to a standard year, likely 4 years of retention before you have to make a decision. And that allows the teams, A, if they pick a CHL kid, it gives them more runway. And B, it prevents CHL kids from making the jump to college after those 2 years and then immediately becoming free agents. So, all sorts of things that have to get sorted out. I think that the CHL teams that work with NCAA schools, develop relationships with NCAA schools, begin to bring players who are committed to certain programs into their programs in the OHL, or the WHL, or the QMJHL. Those are the teams that are going to make hay because they're going to get the top kids at 16 and 17 years old, and they're going to be working with NCAA programs. The teams that don't do that, the old school teams, and I've heard about teams that are already building those relationships, whether it's with an agency or with the school. The teams that don't do that and think that they're still going to be able to get top players, I think, are in for a very rude awakening, and it could be hard on a lot of programs. There's definitely a risk that the rich get richer in the CHL out of all of this, that more and more kids want to play for the London Knights and the Oshawa Generals and the Kitchener Rangers and the Portland Winterhawks and the Edmonton Oil Kings and the Halifax Mooseheads and the St. John Sea Dogs and the Moncton Wildcats. But I still think there's an opportunity for some lesser sort of programs, if you will, or smaller communities to continue to try to lure players and compete. They might have to do it a little bit differently, but I do think there's a pathway for them. And then obviously we've got the Penticton Vs who are joining the WHL, and they'll be followed by Chilliwack joining the WHL. And there's a changing landscape in terms of potentially more American markets. But USA Hockey is expected to fight that. Obviously, there were rumors about Youngstown, not rumors. It's factual that Youngstown and Muskegon tried to leave the USHL and were being considered for by the OHL for expansion. USA Hockey has the final say on that and has said, basically over my dead body. It's not going to happen. So those programs will be staying in the USHL moving forward. And there had also been talk of the QMJHL maybe trying to get into Maine or Connecticut. But I think that's going to be a challenge with USA Hockey wanting to protect its levels. Different if you're a CHL program that is already in an American market, like a Saginaw or Flint, Everett, go down the list, Seattle, Portland. But it's going to be a big change, and we're going to see first round picks going to college hockey instead of signing ELCs. Like that's happening. I know it's happening. It's going to be imminent here in the next couple of months as all of these kids announce their commitments, and then they're going to be at school in August, and instead of going to NHL training camps and that kind of a thing, it's going to be a bit of a different path post draft for a lot of these kids. There are kids from last year's draft that I actually think could have benefited from it. I was in Oshawa last night for the OHL championship. Well, wouldn't it be great if Sam Dickinson and Beckett Senecky could go and play college hockey next year instead of having to make the choice of NHL or returning to junior? Player like Senecky could probably benefit from continuing to play junior, playing at the World Juniors, but a player like Sam Dickinson, who led the OHL in points by defenseman and plus minus this year, or second in the OHL in points by defenseman to Zane Parekh, but led the OHL in plus minus this year, plays 30 minutes a night on the best team in the league. He's quite likely going to have to still play junior next year simply because he signed his entry level contract. So had this rule change happened a year ago, maybe he's a player who doesn't sign, delays signing, and goes and plays college hockey for a year or two, kind of thing. So now Sam will probably start in San Jose at least next year to see where he's at, and then maybe he goes back and he plays at the World Juniors and all of that, and returns to London. But not an ideal pathway, right? For him, that's not the preferred route. And now suddenly for a lot of other kids, for whether it's if Gavin McKenna makes that decision or Landon Dupont makes that decision or any number of the sort of top kids that are going to come through the CHL in the next few years, suddenly once you're done at the junior level, there is a next level that a next step that you can take that wasn't previously available to you. So I think by and large it'll be positive, but the NHL and their member leagues in terms of CHL, USHL, they all need to make sure they're on the same page in terms of how what this looks like and playing ball with each other.
I'm curious because for your take on this, but I remember, I talked to you last time we spoke around this time about Rutger McGroarty and him almost, putting maybe a little bit of a barrel over, the Winnipeg Jets' head just in terms of like, hey, like I could stay at college and then leave as a free agent. And obviously he got traded, went to Pittsburgh. We saw what happened with Cutter Gauthier. There seems to be more player empowerment and, growing up, it's like if you got drafted by the Pittsburgh Penguins, you're going to play for the Pittsburgh Penguins outside of like Eric Lindros, of course, all those years ago. Do you think with that, with the changing landscape and with more player empowerment that, players who gets, drafted by teams are le much less likely to stay with those teams kind of even, by the age of 22 after their 4 years kind of expires?
For sure. I think, and I've heard from plenty of people around the NHL, CHL, USHL, college hockey about worry, all sorts of positives, and people tend to be sort of thinking about this in a positive way. But the negative for a lot of them, and it's something that they're very concerned about, is not that players shouldn't have power, but that players and their families and their agents have too much power now. Obviously, it's in the players' best interest to have more control over all of their decisions. But I think the worry from whether you're a general manager, or a head coach in the CHL, or you're a head coach or a recruiter at a big program like a Michigan or a BU, the worry now is A, that not only that they can make decisions on at the NHL scale in terms of what Rutger McGroarty did, what Cutter Gauthier did, but that they can also make those decisions at their own programs. And if a kid is unhappy with the London Knights, he can skip to college. Or if a kid is unhappy in college, he can skip back to the London Knights. There are actually programs that are worried about it happening more than once, i.e., a kid starts in college, starts on the college route, goes to college for half a season, second semester, things aren't going his way. He's not on the power play. He skips back to London, and then he skips back the following season to a different college and hits the transfer portal or whatever. Even this year, Noah Powell, who I was watching last night in Oshawa, is an example of that. Noah went to Miami, started the year at Miami, then went to Oshawa, didn't go well, went to Oshawa once the rule change happened, spent the second half of the season playing in a top six role on an OHL contending team in Oshawa. Now he's going back to a different college next year. So, and he's a Flyers fourth rounder, obviously. So I think there's worry of that, of just bouncing around and kids and parents and agents having too much say in where their kid goes, and that being a detriment to, well, if you're Val d'Or, how do you compete with Halifax and Quebec and Moncton, and if it's, I mean, you pick, if you're Flint, how do you compete with London and Oshawa, right? If teams are, if players and their agents and their families are already telling you, I don't want to go to your program at the draft, at the OHL draft, when they're 15 years old, they're already making demands, right? So it's a dangerous game, and it's all going to have to get sorted out, and there will likely be rules. We saw a very controversially Aiden Park, who played for the Green Bay Gamblers. He's a re-entry eligible for this year's draft. He played at Shattuck last year and didn't get picked, but was kind of in the conversation to be a late round pick in last year's draft. He then played at Green Bay this year, and when Green Bay's season in the USHL was done, he played three playoff games for the Calgary Hitmen in the WHL. And there are people who are worried about that. Like, you don't want to end up in a, forget that, but could Connor Bedard, when his season's over, go back and play for the Regina Pats if they're still in the playoffs, right? Like, you obviously never going to
Yeah.
happen, but
No, but
you get into a dangerous game with a lot of these kids where they need to set some boundaries in terms of movement, who can go where, time of the year, when players have to be registered to be on their roster. All of those things need to get sorted out.
how do you think, as a prospects guy who, I listen to your stuff, I read your stuff, like you think about how these guys can develop for, can they take that jump or do they regress or whatever? Like, how do you like this doesn't sound like a great way for players to progress and develop. Like, it doesn't seem like the most optimal way. What do you think about it?
I think as long as some of those boundaries that I talked about are put in place, I do think it becomes an optimal way for these players to develop. At 16, 17, and maybe 18, they're playing a lot of games on a busy schedule, getting a lot of touches, in theory, playing in offensive situations if they're top players in junior hockey. And then at 18, 19, they're playing a lighter schedule. They're getting into the gym. They're getting a little bit of an education. I think all of that is really positive in terms of that CHL to NCAA pipeline that now exists. But there's going to be kids who are caught up in that. I think American kids lose out a little bit because the NCAA is about to get more Canadian. But on the flip side of it, we just saw the OHL draft this spring. More American kids were drafted into the OHL than ever before, because those kids don't necessarily have to go to the USHL now either. So at an earlier age, more Americans are coming into the CHL, and more Canadians are flowing back the other direction into the NCAA. So I do think ultimately it will be positive for everybody. All of these jobs are still, and roster spots are still going to exist. I think you might see some Canadian kids that would have typically been OHL players who don't make their OHL roster, or are a fourth round pick instead of a third round pick, and get treated a little bit differently by their organization. Some of those kids now maybe go to the USHL and play for a Muskegon, or play for a Chicago Steel, or go that route. So there's it's all going to get sorted out. We just have to sort of navigate it over the next 2, 3 years to figure out where this is all going to land.
Well, that was an awesome conversation, and I'm really curious to see where it goes. But I feel like I have to ask you about the 2025 class. Obviously, the Islanders won the lottery. Utah jumped up as well. When I saw you, around Christmas time at the World Juniors, it seemed as though James Higgins was number one. That seems to have changed quite dramatically. You've written about this. Higgins is from New York. Schaefer seems to be close to the consensus number one pick. There's other good players, and we'll probably talk about them later. But what do you think happens at number one? And in your opinion, who's the best player in this draft?
Well, in my opinion, the two best players in the draft are Matthew Schaefer and Michael Mesa. Schaefer is certainly the consensus player. I think even since that World Juniors, even though he only played a game and a little bit of the second game, he was injured in the first period of the second game. think even since then, maybe even since before then, at the CHL USA Prospects Challenge in November, Schaefer was already being viewed as the top guy in this class. Hagans got off to a bit of a slower start, relatively speaking, in college hockey. Didn't have the kind of season that Macklin Celebrini and Adam Fantilli and some of the top freshmen of the last few years have had. Was still a very impactful player, was one of USA's best players at the World Juniors, led USA's forwards in ice time at the World Juniors, 9 points in 7 games, first line center on a gold medal winning team, point per game player in college, which was similar to the numbers that Matty Beniers and Kent Johnson and some others put up in their sort of draft year, post-draft year. So a lot to like about James Hagans still. Dynamic skater and creator with the puck on his stick. I think he's competitive enough, but he's a 5'10", 5'11" center, and he didn't have a massive year. And as a result, you start to look at the other players that did have massive years. And while Schaefer didn't get to finish and put together the sum of a big year, when he was playing hockey, he was clearly the most impressive player in the draft. He was the only player that sort of blew people away on a consistent basis, whether that was in the OHL going end to end for goals with the Erie Otters, whether that was being clearly the best player at the CHL USA Prospects Challenge and the Hlinka Gretzky Cup. CHL USA was obviously sharing the ice with Michael Misa. He was still a cut above, and I thought Misa was great in those 2 games in Oshawa and London. And then obviously the World Juniors, where he was Canada's number one defenseman over Sam Dickinson. And you go down the list, Tanner Molendijk, he looked like their best defenseman. I think Tanner Molendijk and Sam Dickinson were the two best D in the CHL this year. So, a lot to like about him. And on top of that, awesome kid and a brilliant skater, like an unbelievable skater. So, I still think he's the top pick, but I think once you get through that, you talk to scouts, you hear different things. There were people who a year ago, and even for stretches of this season, when he really picked it up in Hockey Allsvenskan, thought that Anton Frundell was the second best player in this draft class, even though he had some sort of cold stretches, wasn't great at U18 Worlds, all of that. There are mixed feelings about Anton, but generally he's very well liked as a 6'1" center who projects as kind of a Anton Lundell. I heard Anze Kopitar, but I think that's getting very carried away. Projects as a excellent second line center kind of thing. Caleb Desnoyers had a huge year and has joined that next group inside that sort of top five conversation. Huge year with Moncton, including in these playoffs, where they're obviously a couple of games away from going to the Memorial Cup at the moment. So and then Hagans and Misa and Porter Martone still in the mix, despite the fact that he's a winger and sort of scouts have softened on him a little bit. Early in the year, I had scouts tell me that they thought Porter Martone out of the gate with the way that he played in those first 15 games of the OHL season, that he was in the conversation for first overall. Now he's might not even be picked in the top five. So things change over the course of a season. That's been especially true in this draft class. Brady Martin has surged. Jake O'Brien has surged. There are other players that have sort of risen into that consensus top group. And then on top of Hagans not having a huge year, at least for a first overall pick, there's going to be a lot of debate amongst teams that are picking 2 to 5, 2 to 6, 2 to 7 kind of thing. So my top forward after Schaefer is still Misa, but that's not necessarily the majority opinion. I think he'd be the consensus number two if you were to poll NHL scouts about it, but there would be disagreement, and there might be three or four names that get listed as the second best prospect in the draft kind of thing. So it's not a foregone conclusion, I don't think, that Misa goes number two to San Jose either. So we'll see how it all plays out. I still think he's probably the front runner to be the pick there, and that Schaefer is still the front runner despite the local connection with Hagans to be the first overall pick. But it feels pretty fluid there, similar to how it felt with Juraj Slafkovský and Shane Wright and Simon Nemec and Logan Cooley and that age group. I think these players are better than those players were, but both below average drafts and sort of at least a little bit of a debate at sort of 1, 2, 3.
I'm curious. I listened to one of your athletic hockey shows about kind of size and how much that weighs into the equation for these, talent evaluators. And for you, with Hagans and there's a couple other, smaller forwards, like maybe going in the top 10, 15. How important, like, how much do you weigh that, and what are maybe other attributes that you look for if the size of a player isn't, if they're not 6'2", 6'3", and below 6 foot?
It's a part of it for sure. It's a huge part of everything that I do. I don't think it can be overstated. I do think there are teams that do put too much emphasis into it, but I understand why they do. I understand why the NHL looks a certain way, why the playoffs look a certain way every year. There is truth to all of that. We can build a team in our minds and on paper, but a team needs to be coached and they need to win hockey games. And that's a tricky process. Now, have I typically been higher on smaller players? Do I think that teams swing the pendulum too far? Absolutely. I was high on Wayne Hudson. I was high on Logan Stankoven. There are Cole Hudson. You go down the list. I think it's really Olin Zellweger. I think it's really important not to sort of rule those players out. This year's draft is particularly interesting that way because you have three kids who, on talent and playing against their peers, are among the best players in this age group. If you were to create a four-team All-Star tournament for the 2025 draft class, I would bet that at this stage in their careers, at this age, that 5'7" Cameron Schmidt, 5'7" Adam Banak, and 5'7" LJ Mooney would all be in it, would all be on those teams. Adam Banak is the Hlinka Gretzky Cup all-time leading scorer now. LJ Mooney was USA's best player at U18 Worlds this year. But that doesn't mean they're first-round picks or even second-round picks or even third-round picks necessarily. So teams have to make that calculation. I have to make that calculation in terms of where I slot players like that. And then at the very top, you better be sure that James Hagans is a stud. And I think he is. I have James Hagans third on my list right now. He's going to be third on my final list. Yeah, would I understand if a team wanted to rank him sixth or seventh on their list? Sure. Would I think they're getting carried away if he's suddenly 9, 10, 11? Yes. But there's an argument to be made for Caleb Desnoyer. There's an argument to be made for Porter Marton. There's an argument to be made for Anton Frundell, for Brady Martin, for Jake O'Brien. All of those guys I would listen to arguments on. As far as the second question, in terms of what I look for, you need to be able to skate. The strength of all of those players, James Hagans is 5'10, 5'10 and a half, 5'11. So it's not the same conversation as the other three kids. But all four of those players are amongst the best skaters in the draft. In fact, I would argue that if I were ranking the five best skaters in the draft, that all of Mooney, Banak, Schmidt, and Hagans might be in the conversation, might be in the mix. So you have to be able to skate. You have to be able to think the game at that level and be one step ahead of people. And you have to be competitive enough. Hagans did struggle at times this year against bigger college teams. There was a weekend in January against Merrimack where he was held scoreless in a two-game set weekend set against Merrimack. And scouts watched that game and got a little worried that he wasn't getting into the inside enough, that he wasn't scoring enough, that he couldn't play in that intensity and that physicality and that kind of a thing. I'm less worried about that with Hagans, but it is important. You need to be able to get to inside ice. You cannot live on the perimeter for your entire career. Or at least if you do, you better be Patrick Kane or Johnny Gaudreau or one of those truly, truly elite talents who can live on the perimeter and then strike to the inside in a split second kind of thing. So it's hard, and you're going to make mistakes. You're going to get little guys wrong. You're going to get the big giants wrong. The 6'5", 6'6" defensemen and 6'5", 6'6" forwards. Their mistakes are made on them all the time. I know you're from Ottawa. Logan Brown. Look back at Logan Brown and the way that
Oh my
Logan
God.
Brown's career played out, right? It's hard. It's really hard. And it's hard for big guys just like it is for little guys. So at the end of the day, everybody would like to draft a 6'2" athlete who can really skate and plays a competitive style and can shoot the puck and handle the puck and play at speed and has high hockey IQ and all of those things. I think that's that 6'1", 6'2", maybe 6'3" spot's the sweet spot, especially for forwards. And then maybe it's 6'3", 6'4" for defensemen. But there are still players at the both extremities, the 6'5", 6'6" types and the 5'7", 5'8", 5'9" types that can work in the NHL. Logan Stankoven scored some big goals in the Stanley Cup playoffs this year, right? And he's not alone. People think that there's only one or two of those kids at all times, but there isn't. I mean, You go back through Matt Zuccarello, Brian Gionta, Taiwer Ennis, Nathan Gerby. There have been tons. Theo Fleury, Guy Lafleur. There have been tons over the years, right? So it is possible, and you can play winning hockey with those players. Now, would you want 12 forwards who look like that? No, but can you have one or two on your roster and still be successful in May and June? I still think you can. So it's a balancing act for sure.
How has your maybe process or, talent evaluation evolved over the past
Oh,
couple of years?
huge. I still tr First of all, I trust my evaluations now more than ever before. Every year I feel better about where I'm at as an evaluator, the things I look for, my process, the time I put into it, the connections I have, the sources I can rely on. That has come a long way. I'm now at a place where I can pick up my phone and text a coach or a general manager with any junior club or a coach at any program in almost any program in college hockey, or even many of the coaches with top programs in Finland and Sweden. I have relationships now, and that is huge. Skating coaches, strength and conditioning coaches, through my storytelling, I've built relationships with these people, and I can rely on them. They can rely on me. It's become a very dynamic relationship in a lot of cases. That's huge. But more important than that is those people can introduce me to players. They can tell me I've got something wrong about a player. But I still need to trust my evaluation. That's what has really changed over the years. We were talking about the size piece. I used to value the little guys too much in the early years. So I've come back towards sort of what the NHL looks like a little bit that way. Now I still trust my evaluations on the little guys, but I'm not as reluctant to believe in the 6'5 defenseman as I was. If they can move and they can make a first pass and they can defend hard, that's a lot of what you need to play defense in today's NHL, right? So and there's always a few guys like that in every draft that make it. So that part of it, but I also just I know what I'm looking for in a player. I think early on you could be charmed by the stick skill or a kid that could absolutely fly or a kid that could rip the puck. I remember watching Kiefer Bellows and Oliver Wahlstrom, and you go down the list. Owen Tippett. Now Owen Tippett's become a very good player, but it took Owen Tippett a long
Took a
time.
while.
And I know in speaking with his strength and conditioning coach for years that it just took him a long time to learn how to play hockey. Obviously, there's tons of examples. Zach Sinishin, the Foodie brothers, the McLeod brothers, those speedsters that have struggled to make it and hit. So it's less and less now for me about that singular tool that pops, and more about the decisions that guys make, whether they can play with pace, whether they can slow the game down, their ability to make good reads and good choices on the puck. Their ability to get open off the puck. Those are the things that I'm more and more looking for now, is just sort of, does a player know how to play hockey? And that's what carries most of the guys to the NHL. There are still those freak athletes or the Kasperi Kapanens of the world, the guys that can really skate, who carve out NHL careers and maybe don't think it well, but pretty much everybody knows how to play hockey now. And for years, that wasn't the case. You talk to people. When I did my book, I talked to scouts from the 70s and 80s and 90s. They didn't care if you knew how to play hockey. They cared if you could clear the net front and box out and block shots, and if you were tough as nails. Those were the things that they valued. All of those things still have value, but you got to be able to keep up at NHL pace. And I don't mean that from a skating standpoint. I mean that from a how fast the game is moving standpoint, from a processing, decision-making, reads. You watch some kids and they just really, really, really struggle with that. Not to go back to Oshawa and London last night, but that's front of mind because I was at game four last night. Cam Allen is a classic example of that. Great athlete, but just doesn't make good reads on the ice. It coughs up a lot of pucks. So those are things that are red flags for me, because it's hard to learn that. You can work on your skating, you can work on your shot, you can get into better physical shape in the gym with a nutritionist, and some of these kids haven't even trained really all that much pre-draft. But you cannot really learn the hockey IQ piece. It's very hard to get better at. So that increasingly is at the center of my evaluations.
Is that something where you watch the playoffs and you almost look at the class coming up or prospects and you're like, okay, that player looks like this play. Like, I'm not saying one to one, but you're almost seeing the mold of players like a Logan Stankoven who is playing well in the playoffs but is undersized, and you're like, okay, that relates to this player or vice versa.
Yeah, for sure. And it all comes back to that decision-making piece. The biggest difference between the NHL and every other level, not just junior hockey, but college hockey, the AHL, the KHL, the SHL, the biggest difference between the NHL when you turn on an NHL game is just how good the hockey looks. And I know that's not a specific answer, but the passes are tape to tape, there's structure. It's incredible, incredible hockey. And from someone who watches a lot of bad hockey, like a ton of bad hockey, and that's what a scout's job is to watch
Yeah, of
bad hockey.
course.
That's what scouts do. They show up to hockey rinks 3 or 4 nights a week and watch shitty hockey. And oh man, you can pick out pretty quickly the kids who aren't going to be able to play good hockey or play hockey at the NHL level. I was just at U18 Worlds, obviously in Texas, saw some of the worst hockey I've ever seen played at that tournament. And the difference between that and then going to the bar with colleagues afterwards and turning on Dallas and Colorado, it's like a completely different sport, right? So, the kids who can think, who you can tell can think it at that early stage, with the kids who are really thinking it at a different level than their peers in junior, those are the kids that I feel most confident about.
Is that almost for you where it's almost like high ceiling sometimes, you know, or a high floor but low ceiling sometimes for guys that can really think it but maybe don't have that those physical attributes? And is there like a player that kind of springs to mind as well?
I think later in the draft you can hit on those low ceiling guys and you can trust projectability and it can become an important part of your evaluation. I do think you need to be taking swings pretty much all the time because if you're drafting a kid to be a fourth line forward or a third pairing defenseman, well, every August there are kids who are just as good as not kids, there are grown men in their late 20s and early 30s in free agency who are just as good as that player is capable of becoming and who are have experience and who have been doing it for 15 years, who are available for $1 million, right? Or $1.5 million or whatever the number is for your run-of-the-mill depth playoff style player, right? So I do think it's incumbent on you to be focusing on guys who can special teams, like even if it's a defensive defenseman who's a low ceiling guy in theory, will he be a PK guy? And then on the flip side, you need to be finding guys who can play on the power play. Now, those guys aren't available. If they were available in the throughout the draft, they'd be first round picks, right? There aren't actually very many first round picks. But I do think you should be trying to find talent. You should be focused on talent. You should be focused on smarts, and those things translate to offense. And the draft is one of the only places that you can find offense that is cost controlled for not just their entry level contract, but for their RFA years. Although RFAs are now getting FA money, so that's a different conversation. But no, it's I still think swings are important. If you're not finding now, not everybody finds the Nikita Kucherov in the second round or the Braden Point in the second round. But if you're not trying to find that, I think you are giving some back to the teams that are. Even if you're maybe finding more NHL players per se, those are the guys that change an organization. And typically those guys are only available in the top five or the top 10, but David Pastrnak was a late first rounder, right? I could give you 50 guys in the NHL who make $5 to $10 million on their NHL team. Look at Toronto and the difference that Matthew Knies has made on his entry level
Oh,
contract for that
such a good player.
organization as a second round player, right? So you have to be looking at impact and ceiling more than floor, I think. But in saying that, if you're strictly focused on ceiling, you're going to have a lot of misses. And in the scouting world, if you miss often or too often and your contract's up, you won't get renewed. These scouts don't just work for organizations for 20 years, or at least the vast majority don't. It's a very tough business where guys go somewhere for 1, 2 years and then their contract's up and they don't get renewed. So I understand the urge to just make sure
To
you're finding, to maybe
yeah.
lower the bar a little bit, but make sure that you're finding NHL guys or AHL guys, that kind of a thing.
How have you seen, because you've been doing this for, a decent chunk of time, how have you seen drafting evolve in terms of like the NHL and maybe like teams' priorities? Like, obviously not every team drafts the same way, right? And looks for the same thing, but do you feel like they've evolved from maybe just always looking for the big, kind of grinder guy who can push guys in front out of the net over the past couple of years when the league has got so fast and it's being played at such a higher level.
I actually think on defense, it's begun to swing back towards size. Teams have seen what Vegas built their team to look like, where everybody was 6'4", 6'5", Nick Hague, Alex Pietrangelo, you go down the list. Teams have seen what St. Louis did with Colton Parayko and that blue line, and which also had Alex Pietrangelo. Not a coincidence. Teams have seen even Tampa with Eric Chernak, right? Like it. There's a certain type of player, Brandon Carlo in Boston for all those years. There is still a certain type of player that teams covet, and I think that player on defense in particular is length and mobility is the name of the game and on defense in the NHL these days. You've seen the way that Brad Treliving has rebuilt the Leafs blue line, moving on from players like Rasmus Sandin and Timothy Liljegren in favor of the big long guys. Now Sandin's been at That doesn't mean those guys can't play on winning teams, right? Sandin's been a very good player for a Washington Capitals team that won the President's Trophy this year. Actually, did Winnipeg win
They,
the
no,
yeah.
Winnipeg, they came
Yeah.
second, but they won the
Yeah,
East.
yeah. But no, it's tricky though because you start to look at the shape and size of NHL rosters and the way the teams are built. I certainly think on defense, teams are definitely prioritizing length. It's hard to make it as a 5'11 defenseman now unless you're Cale Makar or Adam Fox or Wayne Hudson or that type. But it still can be done. There's a kid named Cam Reid in this year's draft who's like 5'11 and a half, 6 foot, and isn't the dynamic offensive talent. And I think he's going to be a very good NHL player. I thought Denton Mateychuk had a great rookie season for the Columbus Blue Jackets this year, right? So there are players of different shapes and sizes that can still make it, but on D, it's going that way. And up front, coming out of the lockout in terms of how things have changed over the years, when I first started doing this 12 years ago, there was a belief coming out of two lockouts pretty close together that it was going to become a sprint, that in neutral ice, everybody was going to fly north-south, and that the name of the game was going to be speed. And because the clutch and grab was gone and the game was changing, and I think that's happened to a certain degree, but the game still really slows down in the offensive zone. Once you get down ice, you have to stop in the offensive zone and make plays, right? Not everything happens off the rush. And as a result, I think teams are now coming back around to the fact that skating and speed is not everything. And that in many cases, guys who are too fast actually struggle with the pace of the NHL game in terms of getting too far ahead, putting themselves into the corner, putting themselves in bad spots, not flowing with the play and with their line mates. So it's a nuanced conversation, but I do think up front, there's maybe not the emphasis on size that there used to be. The goons are gone. Fourth lines now look different than they used to. There's still Tom Wilson still exists, and there's still guys like that, but the Ryan Reeveses of the world, like that job on an NHL roster no longer exists. You need to be able to contribute in a bottom six role. You need to be able to create offense. Teams with deep four line teams with skill up and down their lineup are winning playoff games right now. Carolina is a perfect example of that. Now Carolina has built their team a little bit differently and they haven't gotten over the hump. So there are questions to ask as to whether that player type and the type of team that they want to be is actually conducive to winning in the playoffs. I think goaltending over the years has actually gotten in the way of that for the Hurricanes. They haven't really had the guy. No disrespect to Kochetkov or Freddie Anderson, but they haven't had someone really grab it for them. But it's, I mean, look at the way that the Dallas Stars are built. The Dallas Stars have guys who are capable of putting up 40 or 50 points playing on their fourth line, right? So, it is doable. to build a roster that way. And in years past, teams never felt that way. Teams felt that third line had to be a checking line, and your fourth line had to pound guys into the ground, and your top six guys were your playmakers. And that has for sure changed, even in the 12 years I've been doing it.
I want to, before I let you go, and thanks again for taking that, I just want to do like a quick roundup of kind of some prospects on some Canadian teams. And you were high on Demidov, and I'm just curious how you feel about that and what you see him kind of projecting moving forward in the NHL. He looked really good in the regular season, didn't really produce in the playoffs, but that Habs team didn't play that well in those five games against Washington. So I'm just curious about how you would evaluate him now, a year after getting drafted.
Yeah, obviously a brilliant year in the KHL, an excellent NHL debut, and then there was this swell of excitement over this incredible season that he'd had, and the fact that he was over here earlier than people realized and playing at the Bell Center, which is the best barn in the league, and all of
Yeah.
it just created a great moment when he first arrived. And then he started playing, and it looked, at least in the playoffs, to me, like the pace was a little much for him of playoff hockey. The big question with Demidov has always been about his pace of play and his skating. He likes to slow it down. He likes to take guys one-on-one and beat them side to side. He's not a speedy skater. I think he's an underrated skater, but he's not fast. So there's going to be some learning next year. I think it'll be important for them. They lowered him in the lineup in the playoffs, obviously, and limited his minutes. I think it'll be important for them not to do that next year, despite the fact that they're trying to get better and that they've taken this step towards the playoffs. I still don't think wins and losses should necessarily be the priority for Montreal next year. I think there's a chance they miss the playoffs next year as well. But if he needs to play with good players and talented players, because him elevating that group and becoming that 80, 90, that superstar is the single most important outcome for them. We know what Lane Hutson is now. We know what now Lane Hutson, I still think, has another level, but we know what Lane Hutson is. We know what Nick Suzuki is, and we know what they need, which is someone who can produce like Nick Suzuki, or maybe even better than Nick Suzuki, and really change what that offensive outlook looks like for that team. And Demidov is the only player within the organization who I think is capable of doing that. I don't think Cole Caufield necessarily has an entire other level where he becomes this transcendent player for them. I don't think Juraj Slafkovský has that. It has to be Demidov, and that's a lot of pressure on the kid, but they need to make sure that they're putting him in a position to succeed, that he's on their first power play, that he's playing with some of those guys. I know they really liked the Caufield, Demidov, Slafkovský line. I don't think they have to necessarily be married to that. But he's an interesting one, man. I can't wait to watch him all of next year. I'll be fascinated to see whether he maybe struggles a little bit and has a 35, 40-point season, or whether he can really have the kind of year that Michkov had, for example, and have a 60-point rookie season.
I want to take you to Ottawa where I am because Yakimchuk obviously was selected over guys like Dickinson, Bouilliam, Parekh that in retrospect right now might not be the correct choice, but there's still plenty of time. I'm curious, like, how would you evaluate how he did this season, and maybe like how do you feel about his prospects moving forward as a player?
Well, I will say I thought he just had an okay year. Calgary was a good team, and he was a top player on a good team, and he was still a top producer in the OHL, but he did not elevate his game and really own that level and dominate that level like I thought he might be capable of coming out of a very strong training camp with the Sens. I was in Buffalo for their rookie tournament. He had some real highs and lows in the rookie tournament. I thought he really struggled in a couple of the games at the rookie tournament, but also made a lot of plays and was one of the only players on a, frankly, pretty brutal, ugly rookie tournament roster who was actually making things happen. It felt like I was only, when I was watching those games, like it was just him and Stephen Holiday who were out there actually doing anything. So that was a part of it, but he didn't dominate. And physically, he's already bigger and stronger than everybody at that level, but he's athletically, he isn't, if that makes any sense. So He still has work to do on his footwork and his mobility, and he can look a little awkward and clumsy out there skating from a skating perspective. So that's going to be really important. Like, if he wants to, I think ideally you're hoping that he's just this big, strong offensive defenseman. Like, best, now Brent Burns is like a borderline Hall of Famer, but that's, I think Brent Burns is kind of what you're hoping that Yakimchuk can potentially be. He also does, yeah, in speaking with Yakimchuk many times over the last couple of years, he certainly doesn't have the personality that Brent Burns has,
No,
but
no.
he's a pretty reserved,
Yep.
kind of almost awkward, shy kid,
Yeah,
Yakimchuk, which
yeah.
is funny considering he'll pound you on the ice and drop the gloves, and he's physical and he likes to chirp guys, but he doesn't really have that off the ice. I don't think he's ever going to be a captain or anything like that. But can he become a top offensive defenseman? Still, yes. Would I take him today over any of those players that you just mentioned, Dickinson, Parekh, Boyum? The answer is no. I wouldn't have taken him at the time, but I still wouldn't take him today. So very high-end prospect. I know he really impressed them, and I've spoken to Steos about it. I know he really impressed them in training camp, and they thought about putting him on the opening night roster, and I would expect that he'll start in the NHL next year and go from there.
Do you feel he's ready to play in the NHL next year?
I think he's, as long as you can live with him getting burned a little bit, I think he's gonna develop. He's going to get by defensively. I think he'll have some struggles defensively, but I think he'll get by on his physicality and his strength. And then inside the offensive zone, he's 6'3", 6'4", and he's got excellent, unbelievable hands, frankly, and he can really shoot it, and he's going to make some plays, and he can contribute on their power play. And I know they've got Sanderson and Shabbat, and they've got guys for the power play and all that, but I think he'll contribute right away on the power play. They'll find a role for him. And they're probably going to have, my guess would be that they're probably going to have to shelter him defensively, because the speed, I think, will be a struggle for him. And then it's just going to be about him getting in the gym and getting a little quicker.
Do you think, like, what are your thoughts on them putting him in the AHL and kind of molding him for at least a year? Or do you feel like that they should rush him or put him, like, I'm just kind of curious because I
No, I
thought
have.
he was, but you're the prospect guy, so I
No,
trust
I
you.
absolutely think Belleville could be a benefit to him, gets him out of the spotlight in Ottawa. Ottawa is still trying to be a playoff team again next year. I think there's absolutely a case for Belleville for him. Now, does he start regardless in the NHL? Probably.
Maybe.
But I think you go from there, and he, I yeah yeah I mean, we just watched what Logan Mailloux has done over the last couple of years. Logan is further along in terms of the skating piece of the puzzle, but there are similarities in the rest of their game in terms of not the greatest decision makers on the ice, struggle with sort of coughing pucks up and turnovers, but extremely big, strong kids who are very, very talented with the puck on their stick. And Mailloux, it has taken him a couple of years, but Logan has become a very, very impactful, even dominant at times, AHL player, and I now expect will be an NHL player and have a really good NHL career, and has had to learn the game defensively and learn when to take chances. And I think that the AHL is a good place for that for some of these kids.
The player that at the time I wanted the Senators to pick was Zane Parekh. He's obviously had a standout year. Somehow didn't make Team Canada, but he wasn't the only one that didn't make Team Canada, and better than me about that. But I just curious, where how do you feel about him like a year, after getting selected, and do you feel like he played an NHL game? Or maybe one or two last year. Like, do you feel like he's ready to kind of break out next year at the NHL level, at the AHL level? Like, what do you think's next for him?
Well, Zane's not, because of his birthday, he's not eligible like Carter is
Oh.
to play in the AHL. But a bit of a tale of two seasons for Zane. He wasn't good in train, unlike Parekh, he wasn't good in training camp with Calgary. He really struggled. They sent him home much earlier than kids who are top 10 picks usually get sent home. Part of it, he told people and told me as well, was that he had a really short summer last year, played all the way, obviously, until the Memorial Cup. Then you've got the draft and development camps. He didn't really get much time to train in the offseason. He was basically right into his first camp with Calgary, and had a little bit of that sort of deep playoff run hangover in terms of his body not being where he wanted it to be when this season started. But then even after he went back to Saginaw, he was still making plays and putting up points, but he wasn't having the kind of impact that he was capable of having in the first, let's say, October, November. And I think that impacted the perception that Hockey Canada had of him, impacted him not making that team. Then in Ottawa for selection camp, I thought he also wasn't very good. He was a late call, and I think he should have been on that team as a power play guy, but at minimum, and I think he defends better than people realize. And his assistant coach, Chris Lazary, was an assistant coach on that team. And Laz loves him. I know Laz loves him. So all of that sort of played into it. I still think he should have made that team, but he wasn't good in that camp. And as a result, as a late invite who had already been off to a tough year, it just, I don't think the average fan who was upset that he wasn't on that team sort of understood the way that it played out and the fact that he probably didn't, quote unquote, deserve to make that team, even if he should have been on that team from a talent perspective. And they could have really used him on the power play, especially after Matthew Schaefer went down and they felt like they had to use Oliver Bonk on their first power play.
Bumper bonk.
Bumper Bonk, except not in the bumper. Yeah, extremely frustrating to watch them try to navigate that. But after that, though, he was great. Like, he came back from that snub at the World Junior Selection Camp, and in from December through till the end of the season, he was not only the most dangerous defenseman in junior hockey, he was one of the most dangerous players in junior hockey. And I would include Gavin McKenna, Berkeley Catton, Michael Misa, you name it. Like, he, every time he was on the ice, he was a threat to make something happen. And on top of that, he was penalty killing and playing 30 minutes a night for Saginaw. And, he was excellent, excellent, excellent. And obviously had another 100-point season, and he seems to score 30 goals and 100 points or whatever. Like, it's clockwork, right? So, and then I thought he was very noticeable and made some plays in the in his brief time in the NHL as well. So now you look at Zane and you think he's got to start in the NHL next year. He's got to run their power play. And is there a team in the league that could use an injection of skill more than
My
Calgary,
God.
right? Like, he just seems like the perfect type of player for them. They don't always get kids who want to be Calgary Flames, but I know Zane is ex like, he wants to be a Flame and make a difference there long term. And it's a really good situation for him, I think, in Calgary. And I expect that he's going to be a transformative offensive defenseman in the NHL for them. And I would not be surprised in the least if we're talking about him having a point per game season as a defenseman someday. Like, and I've said that about, like, I didn't say that about Aaron Ekblad or Owen Power, kids that went first overall, right? Like, now I thought Quinn Hughes had a chance to do that. Lane is Lane. Who knew? I was very high on Lane. I had him 18th on my list, but who knew that Lane was even going to be this talented? There were always questions about whether he was going to grow to where he's now grown to and all of that. Rasmus Dahlin was certainly, like, Rasmus Dahlin broke ankles in the SHL in his draft year and it was extremely, extremely skilled on the puck. But Zane is, like, he's special offensively. So the question with Zane has just always been, there's a lot of stick waving and he has this upright posture and he doesn't maybe look like the most engaged or competitive kid. I think that undersells him. He is actually an ultra competitor and a pest and has gotten in trouble with suspensions and discipline and all of that in the OHL. And I think we're going to see him get suspended in the NHL at some point because he's going to cross check somebody or whatever. So I think his competitiveness is maybe misplaced sometimes, but Zane, as far as the talent, is one of the most gifted young players in the world right now. So.
The just last one, and thanks again for taking the time and doing this. I'm curious about Easton Cowan because he had a pretty tumultuous World Juniors. The Leafs have basically no prospects now because they've traded all their picks and, prospects at the deadline. Just what do you see from him moving forward? Do you feel like he's an NHL player next year? And obviously he's in the OHL championship right now, but just what do you expect from him?
Yeah, I think Easton starts with the Leafs next year. I'd be pretty surprised if it doesn't go that way. I think they need cheap young talent, first of all. But I also think he's the type of player who doesn't have to be, despite being a fucking OHL playoff MVP and one of the leading scorers in the history of playoff hockey in the OHL now, and certainly with the London Knights, obviously broke the London Knights playoff scoring record a couple of nights ago. despite all of that, he's a kid who just plays with a ton of energy and intensity and work ethic, and he's physical and he plays with a bit of a chip on his shoulder, and that is conducive to him playing in a bottom six role early on in the NHL. Like, he doesn't have to be an offensive guy right
Right.
away. I actually think part of the problem he faced with Team Canada at the World Juniors was that they needed him to be a playmaker for them, and he doesn't actually think the game all that well. He's a player who plays on instinct and makes the first play he sees and can make mistakes out there, but that's always just, you've always lived with it because he works so hard and he is talented and he can skate and he can make plays. But at the World Juniors, it just looked like he was like, okay, I'm a returnee, I have to make plays. And he just went out there and tried to beat everybody. And he was shooting from all those horrible angles and just didn't seem like he knew how to make it, how to sort of play his style and make an impact. In returning to the OHL, he's done that though. Obviously, the point streak was talked about and all of that, but he's had another excellent playoffs for them and will be a big part of them for the at the Memorial Cup, which I presume they'll go to. They're up 3-1 in their series as we record this with Oshawa. I think he's a bottom six player for the Leafs next year. I think if you put him on the third line wing, put him at third line wing, swap him into the lineup where they've played players like, oddly enough, they've really struggled with some of those wing spots this year, right? Calle Järnkrok, Max Pacioretty, Pontus Holmberg has played center and the wing, Nick Robertson. They haven't really found what works for them on the wing in the bottom six. And as a result, there's an opportunity for him to play that role next year. So now they're going to have different players and free agency and all that, but I think he starts the year there.
Scott, thanks so much for taking the time and doing this. I really appreciate it. Is there anything you want to plug just before I let you go?
No, not really. Just draft coverage full force at the Athletic over the next month and a half as we lead into Los Angeles. I'll have my on June 2nd, my top 100 is penciled in, which
Okay.
is obviously my biggest project of the year. But I'll have overage rankings. I'll have more features on some of the kids coming. I'll have mock drafts. Corey and I will do debate pieces on the guys that we disagree on. All of that is right around the corner here in full swing. We've got, for the first time ever, we're doing a massive prospect player survey that I've worked all year
Oh,
on.
cool.
In the past, we've done NHL scout surveys, and we'll continue to do those types of pieces. I love that stuff, and I know our readers do too. But this year, I spent all year asking anonymous questions to, we're up to 40 plus, but after the combine, I'm hoping to get to 60 kids, idea like the 60 top kids, all the first and second rounders. We've asked them a ton of anonymous questions about each other, about the draft, about whether they read their
That's
draft
cool.
rankings, all sorts of stuff. So, a huge project that we're trying for the first time that I'm hoping is a big
That's
hit,
awesome.
and that I don't think has really ever been done. So that would maybe be my big plug. That's the piece I'm most looking forward to getting out there this cycle is that player survey that we're doing. We do it obviously for the NHL, the NBA, the MLB. It's a huge thing that we do at the Athletic, but I've put a lot of time all year into asking these sort of same 10 questions to all the top kids and giving them anonymity so that they actually give good answers.
Is there a favorite like line that you've heard so far, or should we save it for the story or something that
No,
kind of jumps out?
there's nothing that really pops to mind. I mean, we've asked them whether they're considering NCAA. We've asked them to rank the two OHL guys and to sort of tell us who they'd pick, all that kind of stuff. So which NHL team they would like to draft them, which NHL team they wouldn't like to draft them. Some fun stuff that I think will be revealing.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Scott, for taking the time and doing this. I'm really excited for that story and all your stories ahead of your own June Christmas in terms of the draft and everything coming up. So thanks again for taking the time and doing this. I really appreciate it and good luck.
Yeah, no sweat. And then as soon as LA wraps up, we'll be talking about Gavin McKenna for a year.
There you
So we
go.
have that to
I
look
think you'll
forward
be
to.
excited about that.
Yeah.
Thank you.